Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then, add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to Silver Screen Cinema Classics, the show where the past beams into the present and the popcorn's always buttery. I'm your host, Mike, and today we're teaming up with our Miss Doctor Who for a very special crossover event. We're jumping into our time machines, or police boxes, and heading back to 1966 for a technical showdown with some of the most iconic villains in the galaxy. That's right, we're talking Daleks' Invasion Earth 2150 AD, the Peter Cushing sequel that's part B-movie spectacle, part swinging 60s chaos, and all kinds of campy goodness. It's the film where the Daleks invade, the Robo-Men march, and Sugar Puffs apparently fund the resistance, because nothing says dystopian future like a hearty breakfast and a close-up of a cereal box. But I am not flying solo through this robo-apocalypse. Joining me, as always, is my co-pilot through cinematic space-time, DK.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right. Looking forward to talking about this one.
Yeah, I know you're a fan of the Peter Cushing films, and we've already discussed Doctor Who and the Daleks, so time to tackle the sequel.
Yes.
Awesome.
And, I'm done in my leather robo-man gear as we speak.
I'd love to see that.
Be careful what you wish for.
Very probably. And we've called in a very special companion for this invasion, our resident Time Lord enthusiast, collector of obscure sci-fi trivia, it's Will Templar. He's back.
Hello, welcome back. Hello. I can't even be back like a bad penny.
No, we were going to have you back. I mean, you were on the review of the Dalek Invasion of Earth, so we can definitely do a compare and contrast. That would be over on the Hit or Miss channel, but still, this is a remake of that, so yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
I mean, originally I wasn't going to come onto this one, but then I realised when you re-uploaded the Doctor Who and the Daleks movie review, but I was on that, I completely forgot about that recording, so I was like, it would also make sense if I was on the other Peter Cushing movie, so the same three of us talking about it.
Yes.
Why not? Just that, like, that little loop back is quite nice. So I thought I'd jump on.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm pleased to have you here. And it was 2 years ago that we reviewed Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Sure. So
understandable you wouldn't fully remember that one, I guess. So, yeah. Anyway, before we get stuck into exploding sheds, mind-controlled robo-men, and the most dramatic Dalek crashes in film history, we're going to take a little detour because, Will, this is the first time you've been on Silver Screen Cinema Classics. Unless I'm massively
something. I think so.
I'm going to ask you the question that we ask all of our guests, which is, what is your favourite cinema classic film? And by that, I mean any film basically released from the dawn of cinema to around 1979. It's completely up to you.
Oh, bloody hell. Is it cheap to say the 1979 film Alien?
No, like, not at all.
Right on the cusp of that. Is that considered a classic? Must be, right?
Definitely, yeah. We covered it on Cinema Classics, so it better be.
Yeah. I'd probably say Alien, just because that is the biggest one that I can think of. Although I do, you know, I'm sure there are about 5 or 6 other films out there from, like, the 60s. Like the one with Chris Kringle. Love that film. What's that? That's a brilliant film as well. But I just can't think of any more off the top of my head, so probably be one of those two.
Yeah, you're one of the few people that wouldn't immediately go to Star Wars, at least.
No, haven't seen that yet.
You have?
We reviewed it. Star Wars, I thought you meant Star Trek. I was like, bloody hell, no, I haven't seen Star Trek films.
No, yeah, you don't want to watch Star Trek motion picture anyway, unless you're feeling particularly, you know, like you need a good nap. But but anyway. So, yeah, well, that was painless. So, yeah, Alien, I think, is a very good choice and sticks to the sort of sci-fi theme that we're going with in this episode. So, yeah, that's about it. There's nothing else to really say about that other than, with that out of the way, we'll jump into the main bulk of the review. We're not doing much else because it's obviously a long film that we're going to review, and it's how we do things at Cinema Classics. And we always start off, of course, by going behind the scenes. And for that, I always call on trusty companion DK. So, DK, I gave you some information. You gathered some for yourself. What do you have for us on Daleks Invasion Earth?
Yeah, obviously this is the second of two films based on the British science fiction TV series Doctor Who. It's the sequel to Doctor Who and the Daleks from 1965. It's based on the Doctor Who television serial The Dalek Invasion of Earth, which was broadcast in 1964 and produced by the BBC. The film was not intended to form part of the ongoing storylines of the TV series, though elements from the programme are used. Various characters, that kind of thing. The Daleks and Police Box Time Machine, albeit in reimagined forms. Now, a number of the film's cast, they've also had roles in the Doctor Who TV series. We'll go to the obvious one. Bernard Cribbins appeared as recurring character Wilfred Mott between 2007 and 2010. And again in 2023, during which it's revealed he's the grandfather of companion Donna Noble. Philip Maddock appeared four times in the series and in a number of Big Finish Productions Doctor Who audio adventures in different roles. Eileen Way appeared as Old Mother in the Doctor Who TV serial An Unearthly Child and as Corella in The Creature from the Pit. Roger Avon appeared as Safadin in The Crusade, or Safadin, I forgot how it's been a while, you know, I've slept, and as Daxter in The Daleks' Master Plan. Robert Jewell was a Dalek and creature operator, and David Graham and Peter Hawkins provided Dalek and other voices in the series. Now, the film was part financed by the Quaker Oats Company, then makers of the
Shuttles. No.
I know, did you spot it? It was a blink and you miss it thing. But, in return for an exclusive merchandising deal, Quaker combined with the film team in a £50,000 campaign, which included 3.5 million boxes of Sugar Puffs advertising the film and a competition to win toy Louis Marx's Daleks, or the top prize, a full-size Dalek prop. Several posters, and, you know, the eagle-eyed among the audience will spot them, several posters for Sugar Puff cereal are visible during the movie, and an early, for a British film, example of product placement. And two special screenings for grocery traders were also arranged via the deal with executive producer Joe Vigoda.
I should say, by the way, I just did a minute at this point. I don't know if you've got the 4K kind of box set of this film, but it comes with a reproduction of like the original booklet that would have been handed out for press and stuff. And at the back of the booklet, it has that competition, the Quaker Oats win a life-size Dalek.
Oh, I'll have to check that out. This is another one of those examples that... yeah. Never looked.
The one that you don't even realize what you've got, but yeah. I only sent you a picture and was like, if I fill this in now, do you think it's still going to... Am I only with a chance or do you think it's past the date?
Yeah, I think you might have missed the expiry date on that one, dude.
Just a bit, yeah.
Yeah, this film's budget, it was 106,000. I don't know why the six, but it's 106,000 more than its predecessor, Doctor Who and the Daleks, just a year earlier. The production was complicated by the illness of Peter Cushing, which required some rewriting of the script to reduce his on-screen appearances. There were also a number of accidents on set. A Dalek prop caught fire during the filming of Rebels storming the Dalek spaceship. Stuntman Eddie Powell broke his ankle during a scene in which his character is killed by the Daleks while trying to escape from them. And actor Andrew Keir hurt his wrist when punching through a van windscreen during a sequence in which his character Wyler and Susan escape from London. Now, despite bearing the credit an Aru production, this film and its forerunner were made entirely by Amicus. Aru received the sole production credit as part of a co-finance deal with Amicus, which felt it couldn't afford to make a movie of this scale by itself. The film's trailer curiously contained no direct reference to either the Daleks, the Doctor, or the TARDIS, or should I say Doctor Who?
And I will say, I watched that trailer, and that's a very vague way of putting it, because although it doesn't make direct reference to them by name, it may as well do. Because it's like, look at this time-traveling man. Look at these mechanical creatures. It's like, okay, you don't say the actual word, but it's not like you're ignoring them.
Look at those silver people with handlebars for heads. In 1995, a documentary about the two Dalek films, Dalek Mania, was released on video. It revealed details about the production, spin-offs, and publicity campaigns. It was later included as an extra in many of the home media video releases of these two Dalek movies. And that's all what I've got at the moment, although when it comes to each section, I have a bit, or a lot, depending on your point of view, to go.
Fair enough. I have tiny bits, but you may have covered some of it, but we'll get into it. So, so before we get into the bulk of the sort of breaking down each section, which I always say, in case you're listening and new, we break it into sections for our notes, but we don't stick visually to them, but that would usually be writing, directing, VFX, music and sound, acting, et cetera, et cetera. But before we do any of that, I tend to always go around and ask our guests and our co-host here, what was the first time you saw this movie and what can you remember initially thinking about it? Now, Will, in your case, I know that you specifically watched this because you were reviewing Dalek Invasion of Earth. So the first time you watched it was probably, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, less than a month ago I first watched this, and I tried watching it last night, got about half hour in and then fell asleep, so kind of bodes well for this. But
no,
it wasn't an issue with the actual movie, it was the fact that it was 2 a.m. that I decided to do it. I'm on mostly recall from the watch about a month ago, but as you said the other day, it's basically the same as the other episodes, so it'll come back to me very quickly, I'm sure. But
I have got a list that I'll get into about deviations from the TV serial, but it struck me this time because I'd watched them virtually back to back how remarkably similar it is.
Yeah, so different in some key aspects like the cast.
Yeah, I mean, some key things, but then there's also things that are a plus, like getting rid of the slither from the TV episodes.
And the really tedious music, trying some things that I mentioned last time.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Although, to be fair, some of the music in this is equally just kind of like, dude, shush.
Yeah, it's different enough, so it's not the same issue, but equally it's just as bad, but in different ways. But I did find it fascinating because I flipped through the Doctor Who and Daleks review when it first came out, just to see how annoying I was during the recording. As I can imagine, a lot of podcasters do, they just go back, was I annoying? Yes, I was. Bloody hell, I'm not doing that again. But basically, one of my points
I never do that
was I found the extermination effect better in the actual show than these movies. And fascinatingly, I said the exact opposite in the Daleks Invasion of Earth review when compared to this movie. So I've changed my mind in the 2 years since.
But you had a reason for it, because you did say it just to kind of, give the audience, in case they haven't heard the Dalek Invasion of Earth review, you did say in that the reason you like it is that, being that the Daleks are based on Nazis, you felt like having a kind of gas weapon, it makes a bit of sense, I guess, in that regard. So it looks better than the terrible sort of effect that they were trying to do on TV at the time for the laser guns, I guess. So
100%. I think my criticism in the first review of Doctor Who and Daleks was that it kind of just looked like jet wash, and they were just jet washing them to death, and that was stupid. But I can't disagree more, especially, with cinema classics, you've got to look at these things with like a rose-tinted glasses sometimes and realize that they're doing the best they can with what they had. And when you compare it to something like the extermination effect in the actual show in the 60s and early 70s, it is vastly superior, is a better attempt.
Definitely. I personally think that they're scarier in this film than even in Doctor Who and the Daleks, the exterminations, because it doesn't feel so much like they're just kind of, like you said, like trying to shoot a car wash at you as you run away. There's a lot of kind of ambushing people and then three streams of gas just blasting them from all angles, or the particular scene which I remember when we did a review of Victory of the Daleks on the Hit or Miss channel. I was watching an interview with Mark Gatiss, and he said that he was talking about how he'd based the kind of paradigm Daleks on these movie Daleks. and said that he's got a vivid memory. One of his most traumatic experiences was the Daleks surrounding the shed where Philip Maddock's character has betrayed Doctor Who to the Daleks, and they basically, he's like, ah, see, I brought him to you, and then they just exterminate him anyway. There's like about, you know, 10 of them just surrounding the shed, and they just, you know, blow it to smithereens with him inside. And yeah, apparently that was quite traumatic for a young Mark Gatiss, and I was like, that is actually quite a tense, kind of scary scene, especially if you're young, you know?
So, yeah. I mean, conversely, I thought the Daleks were scarier in the TV show, because there was that one particular moment where the Doctor and Co are like outside of the spaceship, and then in the actual TV show of like the Daleks also, in the actual TV show you've got like this really dark setting with like the spotlights that go about moving quite swiftly, and I thought that was really eerie and scary and intimidating, whereas how it was adapted in,
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The movie, it was set during the day. There were way more prisoners there. And the only benefit, like the pro of the movie in that particular scene, was that it was a bigger set, so the guy that tried to make a runner could actually, you know, run about the set and go up some stairs and through the shops and whatever, whereas in the TV show it was a very tiny set, so he got about all of 3 yards before giving up.
But
I just thought the actual set design and the lighting in the TV show made the Daleks scarier than in the movie.
Fair enough. I think that's kind of, that might be a symptom of kind of being in black and white. I think it can make things seem moodier anyway. Yeah, but fair enough. We digress anyway. So moving to, we'll get into a lot of that, I think, sort of differences and what we like and dislike and stuff when we talk about the various sections. But DK, over to you, because I don't actually know the answer to this. When was the first time you saw this? I'm guessing it wasn't 3 weeks ago. And what did you initially think of it?
I must have been 5, 6. So it's going back a bit. I mean, For the edification of the listeners who haven't, you know, been around us for long, I'm old. And this, you know, there was not really home media to speak of. And, you know, other than it being broadcast live on TV, there wasn't really any Doctor Who that you could watch on home media until, I would say, Revenge of the Cybermen, when BBC brought that out as one of their original tapes. And that's probably why I've got an affection for that one. But until that point, other than watching it as it was broadcast, you didn't really see any Doctor Who, and this was the only kind of Doctor Who material available that you could rent from video stores, or they would watch it on TV, which they would show every few bank holidays on TV. And so yeah, I kind of accepted Cushing as the Doctor before I ever even saw Hartnell.
Wow.
So yeah, I was very young when I watched it. Had a huge crush on Roberta Tovey back then. as I got older, that developed into a crush on Jill Curzon. I think we know why that happened. So yeah, I have fond memories of these because I kind of accepted these as Doctor Who before I even got into the series proper.
Cool, fair enough. So you kind of, you would have been very young, and it might have been the first Doctor Who you ever saw, in fact. So,
I do think I saw the TV serial first. I as I say, Creature from the Pit. So, this was a much more pleasant experience for me going into it.
No wonder you think this is good. If that was the comparison.
That's probably why I stuck with these movies. I still have tremendous affection for them.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, definitely. Just to give you my background with it, I can't remember exactly how old I was, but I know I would have been anywhere between the age of like 5 and 10, probably. And I first saw this when it was on, I think, Channel 4. It was one of the broadcast channels here in the UK anyway, because it used to show quite often, being a British film, I guess, and being like family friendly, so you could put it on in the middle of the afternoon, which is when I saw it. But I didn't see the start of it, so I vividly remember seeing the kind of last half hour and just loving the, because it seems, if you only watch that, that it's really action packed. You've got that kind of James Bond worthy set of the Daleks kind of spaceship, and there's what looks like loads of Daleks, especially when you're young, and then they have the Robo-Men try to attack them, and they put down that kind of rebellion. Then they kind of, you know, realize the weakness is the magnetic core and destroy the Daleks with that. And I just remember thinking, when the Daleks all go tumbling down, the thing that became 1,000 memes, when they go, you know, for heading down the mineshaft part in the middle, I remember thinking it was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen, because I was so young at the time, and I was like, this is awesome. I want to watch more Dalek stuff. And then you watch it and I say, oh, that doesn't usually happen all the time. They don't go spinning around, falling into holes, like smashing apart with the lights coming off and stuff. But it was so cool at the time. I was like, wow, I bet this film is so cool. Then I think when I saw the first hour, I was like, yeah, not quite as action-packed for the rest of it. But I did love that bit. And then, I mean, the way that the spaceship crashing and stuff like that is a really cool kind of ending to it. And it does, it just seemed epic at the time. And yeah, the vivid memory I have is the multicolored bigger Daleks all kind of going nuts as they get crushed and pulled into the mine and spinning around and falling down. So yeah, that was probably, again, I don't think it was my first ever thing I saw of Doctor Who, but it would have been one of them. And it was probably after I'd seen a Tom Baker on UK Gold somewhere in passing, and probably, I think, the Ark in Space even. But yeah, watching this, just thinking, wow, I didn't even know there were movies. And I wouldn't have had a clue until much later that it was, you know, not quote-unquote canon, and it was Doctor Who, not the Doctor, and whatever else. I probably just thought, oh, well, a Doctor Who movie.
I think I researched this, and apparently in the Day of the Doctor novelization, it was actually, similarly to the episode Lux recently, it was seen as like a movie, like an in-universe movie of the Doctor's adventures.
And yeah, it was,
of,
yeah.
Kind of in-universe, but as a piece of fiction, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I did. I have that novelization, and it was intended to happen in the Day of the Doctor TV show, but they couldn't get the rights. He was going to include the posters in the Unit Black archive and have it revealed that they are kind of declassified files that Unit gave to a film company, and then had the actor Peter Cushing act out the adventures that the Doctor had already went on, which is why they're remakes of the first two Dalek stories, but there's also differences, you know, like, oh, it's obviously not the Doctor, it's Doctor Who and whatever else. So as you say, in-universe, you can argue that they exist as films, which are slightly wrong accounts of the Doctor's travels.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's interesting way to view it, for sure.
Can get the rights.
Yeah, it would have been nice. I mean, there was a lot in that Black Archive in the Day of the Doctor, and it might have been a nice touch. But as you said, Moffat did restore it for the novelization, because you don't need visually to have them there. So yeah, it's already it's in there. So anyway, cool. Right. If you guys don't mind, then as I say, what I wanted to do next, before we get into the actual sort of nitty-gritty of it all, I have a small, well, smallish, I say small, it's actually quite large, a list of the deviations from the TV serial between Dalek Invasion of Earth and this movie. I just wanted to quickly go over them. If you have any thoughts or comments, feel free to interrupt, just to get it out of the way and to kind of form a companion piece to that review. So I'll start off and say, first of all, obviously, Ian Chesterton and Barbara Wright are replaced by Tom Campbell and Louise. As in the first film, the Daleks, as we said, exterminate their enemies with some sort of gas rather than a directed energy weapon. The Daleks are apparently using solar panels instead of the parabolic discs in order to travel outside of their, you know, static electricity of their planet. I can't remember seeing that in the movie, but I'm reliably informed they do use solar panels. I don't know if that's a deleted scene or it's in the background materials or what, I don't know. Mm. One thing I do like as an improvement, Doctor Who breaks out of the cell in the Dalek saucer using a comb, rather than the first Doctor's more advanced form of intelligence test, which I've never really liked in the TV show, because it just feels like it stops everything dead, and you're in the middle of a science lesson and it still doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's a bit weird. In the TV version, David and Susan use the sewers to avoid the Daleks. The only time that a sewer is featured in the film is when Doctor Who and David briefly hide from the pursuing Daleks in one. They escape and emerge from a different manhole. There are no scenes of the inside of the sewers and no crocodiles in this one. The character of Larry Marison is absent, another, I would say, improvement. The original subplot of the character going to Bedfordshire to locate his missing brother is eliminated. Again, that was one of the things I said I would have, the first things I would have cut when we reviewed Dalek Invasion of Earth. The character of Jenny is eliminated completely. I mean, you've got enough characters in there, so you could understand that, I think, as well. In the TV version, the Black Marketeer endeavours to smuggle Ian out of the camp. The same character in the film is smuggling Doctor Who and David into the camp. The film does not feature the Slither. Woo! So there's no fight as there was in the TV version, and no terrible-looking effect. In Bedfordshire, the Daleks in the film seem to have some kind of building as their headquarters instead of using the saucer, which was the case in the Dalek invasion of Earth. In the TV version, the Robo-Men rebellion is initiated by the Doctor, Ian, and Barbara, impersonating a Dalek and ordering the Robo-Men to, quote, destroy the Daleks. The film's version of the rebellion is initiated by Doctor Who alone, shouting, "Attention all Robo-Men, attack the Daleks," into the microphone without bothering to alter his voice. The Robo-Man rebellion is not the undoing of the Daleks in the film. In fact, it's actually dealt with rather swiftly by the Daleks. The plot's resolution is slightly different. In the TV version, the bomb is diverted to the Dalek ship to destroy them, but in the film, it's the Earth's magnetic properties that drag the Daleks to the Earth's core and destroy the flying saucer in a completely non-scientific process. I'm sure Neil deGrasse Tyson is somewhere complaining about the lack of any common sense in that one. But, you know, it looks cool. Who cares? And finally, two more things. First of all, in the Dalek invasion of Earth, robotizing a human was an irreversible process. It kind of seems like it's supposed to be in this movie, but at the end, Robo-Men are seen fleeing from the mine and seem like they're regular human selves, which seems to imply that they've been freed from their control somehow. It's weird. I think that's a bit of a vague one. And finally, since Susan is depicted as a child in the film, the original subplot of the character's romance with David and being left behind by the Doctor is obviously eliminated. Wouldn't be super appropriate. So yeah, anything stand out there amongst those changes, guys?
It just makes me interested to know how they would have dealt with like Susan's absence in the third movie had it been made, since obviously Susan's not in the chase. Would they have retrospectively added her back in, and then, or would they, I don't know, how would they have done?
I think they would have added her back in, because from what I can gather, Cushing only signed up for this one Roberta Tovey returned, because they built a rapport in that first film. So I don't think he would have signed on for a third one had she not been there.
Right, I literally made the same note under the acting. Yeah, apparently he definitely only agreed to do this if Roberta Tovey came back, yeah. But, I mean, she's the only returning, because you've got no Ian and no Barbara from the first movie. And then you've got this character, like, I'm Doctor Who's niece, who just appears out of nowhere, knows all about the TARDIS and everything, and, like, all right, okay. she's here, I guess. So, yeah, I would imagine they would have included Susan, but she's so different from the character anyway that there's nothing you really have to change. But that, if that film had been made, just to clarify for the audience, there's talk that they were going to make a third Cushing movie based on the Doctor Who serial The Chase, although that's been disputed by some people. Talk is that it might have been called Daleks versus Mekons or something. So it's possible that if that was made, it would have been completely different from the TV serial anyway. My thought has always been it probably would have just adapted the end of The Chase. It's not going to have done the crazy knockabout running around time stuff, and it would really have just been the kind of Daleks and Mechanoids stuff at the end.
To be fair, I would have loved to have seen an Amicus set up in that haunted house.
True, yeah, and I mean, they would have had the materials to do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Fair enough, but no. We'll move into the bulk, and we'll start with, I think, writing and plot is the first thing I have, so may as well begin with that. I don't have any notes for this, DK, but do you have anything you wanted to start us off with?
I've got a couple of things, and you know, they're kind of similar to what you were touching upon. Tom's surname originated when Milton Subotsky adapted Terry Nation's original scripts, which feature a character called David Campbell. This is why Ray Brooks's character in the movie has no surname. Subotsky's original draft, it still featured Barbara. Tom was simply a man who wanted to use a telephone, spotting a police box sitting incongruously in the back garden of a suburban house. He later requested to go 50 years into the future, which would have been 2016. But then it goes on, you know, he also retained the alligator rotting ladder sewer sequence from the TV scripts after they escaped the saucer, and a reference to a transport museum. The character of Ian's ally Larry was regendered as the female character Laurie, who befriends Tom, both being menaced by the metallic slither, but it was ultimately dropped. And Tom would also climb into the bomb, as Chesterton had in the original serial. The draft closed with the TARDIS materialising near Henry V as he orates his St. Crispin's Day speech. And Yeah, during the course of the movie, the Daleks are heard using RELs as a time measurement, which obviously would be used in the comics and TV series. And the only other thing I've got is the scene which I love, which I know for a fact I'm probably the only one in here, because I'm probably the only one in reality that likes it, the Roboman food machine scene. It's thought to have been inserted due to Cushing's illness. It suddenly removed him from the filming schedule and necessitated a bridging sequence. So that's why people believe that scene is there.
Yeah, it's quite on brand, to be fair, for somebody who's playing the equivalent character of William Hartnell to have to bugger off sick and not be available.
It is. It is.
So, yeah. No offense, but yeah, that was when I read that, I was like, huh, weird, because the same exact thing happened in Dalek Invasion of Earth. The Cardinal suffered an injury and had to miss an episode. Cool. So, I have a few notes, but not really that much. I just said, let's see. I did actually have a quick note about Milton Subotsky, as you said, who was the kind of producer and the person that adapted these scripts, along with David Whittaker, adapting Terry Nation's original story, obviously. Apparently, Subotsky reported some slight misgivings over the film, believing that the public's desire to see the Daleks in colour was now sated. He would come to view this as the better of the two films, though, attributing much of their success to the art director Bill Constable. Going from the very start, one of the first things I noted is that the character of Tom is required because you need somebody to set up for the audience the capabilities of TARDIS, what it can do, you know, who the characters all are, that they can travel through time, etc. It's done quickly, but it's something that you don't have to do in the TV show, because week by week you would know the characters and that gives you that advantage. But I kind of figured that's why they included the character of Tom, even though he sticks out like a sore thumb for me in this movie. It's just so...
Oh, really? I love the character of Tom. I think he's... mind you, that could be Bernard Cribbins. That could just be Bernard Cribbins.
Yeah.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
No, I love Cribbins, and it's not that I have an issue with the character. It just feels like he doesn't really have any reason to be going with them to the future. And he kind of, like I said, it just stands out, and he feels like he's there because they wanted to make up the numbers. Because it's the way that he kind of, you know, he obviously, understandably, he thinks that TARDIS is a regular police box and goes in there. And then it's just out of nowhere, Cushing's really even slightly lame delivery of, well, he'll just have to come with us. That's all there is to it. And I'm just like, really? What? Why? I didn't love that. And I mean, it's never really explained at any point, even in the start. Why are they going to 2150 in the first place?
Yeah, I just thought, you know, Pokemon cards. Just accept it and move
on. Should I break out the jewel gif again?
Yes. I think that gif would be very, very much in use during the course of this movie.
Incidentally, has Mystery Science Theater ever covered the Dalek movies? And if not, why not?
They haven't. Riff Tracks, I'm not sure. They may have. I'll have a look while you're talking, actually.
I may have seen that Riff
Tracks. Because it's prime riffing material.
It really is. But, I mean, that's the fun part, isn't it? On the subject of Tom, though, I can't say I noticed this when I was younger watching the movie, but yes, looking back at it now, his kind of final do-over in the time travel situation is impossible by any of the sort of rules and standards set up by the TV show. He crosses his own timeline and effectively replaces, you know, a version of himself that went with Doctor Who in the first place. And the more you think about it, the more you're like, this is just bullshit.
Yeah, to quote what I was saying during the Day of the Daleks episode, Blinovich would have a fit.
Yeah, exactly. So is that something that bothered you? Did you even notice that, Will, or did you just kind of run with it because it's kind of a last-minute gag and like, all right,
whatever. Oh, mate, no, it was egregious. I thought it was going to get mentioned up on here. Yeah, I was like, this would be a Moffat-y thing to do, just like completely disregard it and come up with some technobabble nonsense to justify it. But yeah, I can't justify even that as an ending gag. It kind of just rubs me the wrong way. And for that to be the final moment of the film, it is a bit of a sour taste at the end.
Yeah, and it kind of comes down to what I was saying about like the character of Tom, like I said, because even at points like that, like ending the film with that kind of feels like it's weird. And, you know, as much as you might love it, DK, that stupid freaking comedy knockabout physical comedy scene with the food dispenser machine, it all just feels totally at odds with the rest of the film, because for me, the rest of the movie is surprisingly dark, like much like the kind of Dalek Invasion of Earth serial. It deals with, like, you know, the Earth's being invaded. We have a resistance fighting against them. These are not, and you know, there's humans that will betray you just for food and a black marketeer. These aren't things that are like, you know, happy, good, lucky, easy going. And then you interrupt it for Bernard Cribbins, like I said, making a tit of himself for a solid 5 minutes. And you're like, this is just awful. What are we doing? You know?
I mean, you do have the moment in the actual TV show where you have the moment where it comes out of the conveyor belt very quickly. And that's a bit of comedy. But that lasts all of about 30 seconds until Ian says, or whoever it was, says, to hell with this. We'll put it away, turn it off, let's get out of here. Whereas we have this moment in the film where you mentioned it, it does make sense that it's just because of an absence of an actor that they had to, you know, bridge the gap, because it is about a 4 minute sequence and it's very repetitive in what it's trying to show, where, you know, Bernard Cribbins' character is struggling to, you know, match the actions of the others, and it gets very repetitive because everything the other guys do, he does, but a little sloppily. And I think that gag is very overplayed, especially 4 minutes doesn't seem like a long time to have like that, such a bridging scene. But 4 minutes of basically the same thing in the same room, it's got to be good and compelling. And when it's just like the character that you've kind of grown an affiliation to throughout the film up to that point, start acting like a complete tit, it does jar quite a bit.
Yeah.
Like, You've made a likable character unlikable in a very unlikable scene, which is unforgivable in my opinion.
And I mean, to be, credit where it's due, like in terms of being told you're doing physical comedy, Bernard Cribbins does it really well. He's, you know, he does a great job of it. It's just that, and it's not his fault. He's doing what he's told to do. And I can even understand why they might have included it, because you have a lot of the physical comedy with Roy Castle in Doctor Who and the Daleks, which I think worked, you know, I didn't love it, but I think it worked better than this. You know, oh, it's another, just another soft center when he sits on the chocolates or whatever, you know, and, you know, mucking about on the Daleks planet when he's got to hold both things to keep the doors open or whatever. These things for me worked a little better, but I still didn't even love them then. And like I said, I can see why they were like, oh, we've got another kind of actor who's known for light entertainment, comedy type stuff. Let's give him something to do. But as you said, I think it was such a misfire and went on way too long. It made the character look like a clown to me. So
You've got to look at it this way, that by this point, he'd done several carry-on movies. So he was kind of known for those, you know, weird comedic situations. Yeah. So I'm guessing they just thought, we need to. I mean, when you look at it, if that Robo-Man scene was just put in to cover Cushing's disappearance, then it wasn't intended to be part of the original film. So at that point, you can kind of forgive them for what goes on with Tom Campbell's character at the start and at the end. I mean, I look at the end, it's just a bit of fluff.
That's how I feel about the character as a whole, though. It's just kind of like, it's fluff and it's added for no particular reason other than to give you, we need another actor and we need a known face and a known name to tell the movie and somebody that can do a bit of comedy here and there and whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I do know that they did offer the role. They did offer it to Roy Castle to come back, but he was busy. And so that's why they came up with the character of Tom. And I love Roy Castle, don't get me wrong, but I've always preferred the character of Tom to Ian. I'm like, you know, opposite to you guys. I just, whether it's because I saw him in the Carry On movies as a young age, whether it's because he was like a children's entertainer, I just had this tremendous affection for Bernard Cribbins long before Wilfred Mott. So whether it's because of those, you know, kids TV kind of things that I grew up with, and he was kind of ubiquitous in those days. So as an identifiable character, he was just right there, more so than,
you know, Doctor Who, and I know Doctor Who is, you know, based on obviously the Hartnell one, but he's much more approachable as a character than the Hartnell iteration at first. But it was always Tom. So I kind of like it. I think he's a good audience identification character.
Yeah. And I should say, like, to your point, it's not that I, the dislike of the character isn't that I do, because I don't know the actors and stuff. Like, by the time I'd watched these films, I would have known Roy Castle from Record Breakers, and I would have known Bernard Cribbins from The Wombles and a bunch of other stuff. You know, probably, no doubt he appeared in, like, the Generation Game every now and then as a special guest or whatever. So I would have seen him. But it's just that, like I said, I've always kind of been of the kind of snobbish sci-fi fan, I guess, that's like, I want my sci-fi to be serious and taken seriously. And it kind of, it makes a mockery of it, which is, for me, that kind of, that sucks, because sci-fi is always struggling to sort of gain that credibility anyway.
Honestly, and, dude, if that's how you feel, please never watch Time Lash. Just don't.
Follow your advice anyway.
So no, I don't like. I mean, it's one thing if you aim for serious and you end up with stupid, but to specifically make a mockery of it, I always bristle against and be like, you wouldn't get this in any other genre of film. It's just because you think sci-fi is muck about kids stuff or whatever. But anyway, regardless of that, like I said, I just think it's also that the other thing I was going to say is that it also kind of really detracts from the kind of horror of the Robo-Men, which is actually really quite freakish and scary, especially that one scene where. That the one dude that looks like Rory Kinnear who gets captured with them, who, by the way,
Corrigan.
Completely is that his name? Yeah. I only wrote down Rory Kinnear. I could only see Rory Kinnear. He looks exactly like him. You know who I mean by that? Yeah, the dude who plays. He's in the recent James Bond films and stuff. But yeah. Anyway. And which, like I said, as well, entirely Doctor Who's fault that dude ends up captured, because he's the one that breaks the intelligence test.
In response to your earlier question. If either of you lucky chaps, and I'm going to put my advert on here, so I do want sponsor if anybody from there hears it. If either of you lucky chaps go and signs up to become a Riff Trax friend, they have both Peter Cushing movies. So
I may have to after we, once we're finished recording, I may have to go and do that then. That's
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the original crew, Kevin Murphy, Bill Nelson, and... Mike Nelson and Bill Corbett. So it's you're getting the original Satellite of Love crew doing these.
Oh, awesome. Because, yeah, I mean, I can embrace the campness of it. Do you know what I mean? And I really love the fun, campy aspects of parts of the film, even though, like I said, it's plot-wise quite dark. I just don't love when it's specifically like, let's just make fun of this kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I part of me thinks that the whole thing about, I mean, inserting that Robo-Man section because Cushing wasn't available wasn't necessarily scripted. Part of me thinks, you know, they were just on set one day. Oh, Cushing's not turning up. Here, quick, chuck that on. Go sit down and eat some dolly mixtures.
Yeah, I know that was so stupid because it looked like to me, and I know this isn't even something we have in this country, but it looked to me like they were eating like unmilked Fruit Loops. Like the cereal.
It did. I was thinking, have they like just taken all the marshmallow mateys out of the cereal and just took them on a conveyor belt?
But surely it should have been Sugar Puffs, right?
Well, you'd have thought so, but as I was looking, and I did actually pause it because I wanted to see what they were eating. I do think it's did they have dolly mixtures when you were younger?
Oh yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's those little kind of cuboid ones.
Oh, half the somebody would have had to pick all of those out of the dolly mix.
Yeah, but you know, wow. Half the audience is now going, I'm just sat listening to a bunch of old bastards talking about sweet.
and the guest is thinking exactly that. Yeah.
Will's going, fucking hell, how did I end up with in the geriatrics home?
Oh, anyway.
Yeah, I think it is at odds, but I do think there's some wonderful, I think it does. And like I said, maybe it's come from watching Requiem for a Dream earlier today, but I just like the fact that there's a bit of levity to balance out, you know,
the two women in the
cottage and all that kind of stuff, and Philip Maddox's character, because, the aliens are bad, but, you know, when humanity gets dragged down to their level, and it's not like it doesn't happen, but it can be a little overwhelming, especially what you consider for a family movie.
Yeah,
around that time,
I'll get into a bit of that when we talk about the acting, because there's a lot to say about particularly like Philip Maddock, who's an actor that, like you said, so many important Doctor Who characters in the TV show, and appears in this as well. But yeah, but yeah, to your point, I think I love a bit of levity, but kind of for some reason I just prefer it when it's like unintentional. So like I said, I absolutely adore when the Daleks go spinning out of control, and then clearly, you know, the Dalek prop isn't meant to like shatter off the side of the thing, and then its dome lights come off and be smashed into bits. But it's hilarious to watch.
I love that scene where it's just being pulled down the corridor and they all jump to one side and it just goes smashing. It's like a freaking Looney Tunes cartoon.
It's like a Dodgems or something. And then that one that gets crushed like a tin can just crushes. Wow, okay. So that's the kind of thing I'm here for, levity-wise.
Is Journey's End but good?
Cause yeah, exactly.
Let's actually do it better here.
I don't know again, I'm going to say to your age range, Mike, because you're an old bastard too. Did you remember in arcades where you could go and sit inside a Dalek? Did they have those rides still when you were around?
No.
Oh, yeah. In arcades, when I was really young, Dalek Mania, I presume it was a leftover from that, but...
Okay.
They actually had, you know, they have them outside shops, the little like planes.
Oh, yeah,
that
I know what you mean. We would have had like Postman Pat's van and Fireman's engine and stuff like
I
that.
I had one of those, DK. Western Supermare Pier about 10, 15 years ago. We had one where you could sit in it as well. And it's just outside the actual pier on the actual, you know, pavilion going towards it.
Yeah, you could sit inside him and it would spin round and you could operate the arms and stuff. It was it was really good. But whenever it goes to that scene inside the factory at the end and there's that one Dalek going around kind of like the track, it always makes me think, I just keep thinking, oh, that would be a really cool ride.
Yes, it would actually, because it does look a bit like a kind of a basic-ish ride.
Yeah.
I love that it does that, though. I mean, some people probably would hate that because it does kind of stop the action to have a slow pan just following this Dalek trudging slowly along the... But I'm like, heck, show off the set. Why not? You know, what a massive set. You've got a Dalek that works. Why not make the most of it? I wish I had a little toy Dalek to play with, like a, you know, sit in and control the things. But clearly I was deprived. I had to just pretend I was a, you know, kids' TV characters instead. Yeah. I for some reason, being a huge nerd when it comes to kind of the TV series, I can't watch the scenes now of them all going out of control without hearing them go, "Dizzy Daleks," which I think is the one thing missing. They should have went back and dubbed that in after Evil of the Daleks had aired. That's a heck of a nerd reference, a lost episode as well. I have two more notes and I'll throw it open to you guys if you have anything else about the writing and the plot. First of all, there's no way on earth that you could miss Susan's huge written sign. And they have to go to so many pains to just pretend they're not looking at this massive sign on the door. Dr.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And I think is it David? When they go, oh, if only they'd left us a note. So I'm like, come on. This is unbelievable. At one point, David's facing directly at the freaking door. And it's like, how blind are you guys? So, yeah, I didn't buy that for a second and thought that was ridiculous. Like, they could have at least just had her leave a note that got blown away or something. Having it, you know, huge letters on a door like that just defies credibility for me. And the other note, which I've already kind of said, I just found the music in this so intrusive. It's constant and it's bombastic. And I know it's by Barry Gray, who did all the kind of Gerry Anderson Thunderbird stuff and all that. So that's what he's good at, is that kind of, you know,
pompous march music. Bill McCuffey did some of it.
I noticed Barry Gray's name in the credits, so I presumed, all right, that's why you get that kind of thing, but I think it's necessary.
Yeah, I know it's jumping forwards, but it kind of went from, you know, the bombastic thing, and then a lot of it was experimental jazz. All I kept doing was picturing, great, you know, because it's...
Welcome to Jazz Club.
Yeah. Today we're looking at Peter Cushing as Doctor Who on drums. And yeah. Nice.
Nice. This is Doctor Who and the Daleks with their number one hit, Magnetic. Anyway. So yeah, that was all I had to. So I'm throwing it open. Do you guys have any other notes on the writing and the plot before I move us along?
I'm going to leave it for Will because we've talked way too much.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're going to continue comparing it to the original show, one of my biggest praises of the TV show equivalent of this was the character of Barbara. I thought she was phenomenal in that. However, I think in the movie she was like drastically underwritten. And
well, then she's not there. Do you mean like the Jenny character that's kind of...
Exactly. And I think it's...
What's his niece called? Louise character, sorry. That's
Louise,
yeah. Whoever the hell they're called.
Yeah.
I just think giving some of her moments to, you know, male characters. For example, Barbara was the one who, you know, devised the plan to, you know, intercept the Robot Men using the helmet. I thought that was very clever. So the way they did that in this film was disappointing compared to that. And also you have the iconic moment where she, you know, blasts into the cars. You've just got another character doing that in this film. And I thought it was really disappointing that, you know, some of these key moments from the TV show were given to like these random surplus, you know, non-TARDIS team characters. And such, you don't have the excellent performance from, you know, Jackie and Hill as well.
Oh, definitely. And if I slightly push back against that, because I'd say that for me, there's times when it actually gives those scenes to Susan, possibly because she was in the previous movie. And I will say, despite being prepubescent, I think the Susan of this movie gets way more to do than the Susan of the TV show, whose entire thing is like, oh, I can cook. Oh, I could be your wife. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave. So at least Susan
I'll push back to you on that as well. I feel like a large part of what made episode 3 to 6 tick was that overriding arc of her and David. Whereas you don't really have that. Like, the only moment you really have of this Susan showing a bit of intuitiveness, besides like devising where to go next, is that message that she left on the door that ultimately...
She gets the cool action scene that you were talking about, though, with Wyler, where like she's the one that gets to be in the car as they barrel through the Daleks and see Dortmund sacrifice himself. And she gets all of the really cool kind of stuff to do that was Barbara and Jenny, really, in the TV show. So I kind of think, you know, I agree with you that Louise is pointless as a character. She's there because they needed an older female character and they didn't have access to Barbara. So, you know, she's just there to be, oh, hi, I'm pretty, I guess, or whatever. So not that there's anything wrong with that every now and then, but yeah, I can't remember a single thing that Louise did in the movie and why she has to be Doctor Who's niece or whatever, which they don't get into. It's nonsense. But yeah, I do think Susan, I think, got more to do, and I like Susan a lot more in this movie than I did in the TV show. Even though, like you said, that the impact emotionally of Susan leaving in the TV show is, I think, a miss when it comes to the movie. So, yeah. Sorry.
I'm going to stand up for Louise. I mean, you know, there's only so many people can pull off a sexy, misgendered Sherlock Holmes look, and Louise does it just fine. There's something about those green stockings. I don't know what it is.
I mean, but what does she do in the movie?
She looks good, and she does it better than, you know, better than Barbara in the first one.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, man. I mean, yeah, she's a pretty enough woman, but she does nothing.
Taking me back to Tom again. I can identify with Tom more because in the midst of all this, while they're on the Dalek saucer, he nods off.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah, that would be me as a companion right there.
I thought you were going to say you could identify because he's the one, like, immediately as soon as he gets out of danger, he finds Jill Curzon and starts chasing after her.
Yeah, well, you know, dude's got his priorities right. I'll give him that.
So anyway, Will, we interrupted. Did you have anything else on the writing plot? Sorry.
No, I mean, we touched upon it earlier. It's very similar to the TV show, but Omni is different in some key aspects. Again, we have Barbara. And I just feel like I don't know why they made such key changes like that, just to make it their own thing, perhaps. But if they're just going to do like an adaptation for the big screen, I wish they kept it like basically the same characters and cool elements.
You can't do a six-part story though, because you've got to break down six parts into 90 minutes. Exactly. So you're gonna have to cut something.
But we've spoke about in the Hill Miss session of like another episode. I think it was the one with Cliff, and we spoke about how the Daleks in Colour was basically like a cut down version of that. And then if you were like a theatrical release, then if you didn't want to watch the Daleks in Colour, you've also got the option of watching Doctor Who and the Daleks. And I'd say Doctor Who and the Daleks does a better job at adapting it directly, which it did do, but also maintaining the like a good pace, and keeping all the central ideas and the characters, you know, there. It did a better job at adapting it, whereas this one, I feel like its frustrating parts in my book is the fact that, yes, it's a higher budget. Yes, it's clearly, you know, more polished and whatever, and there's less limitations on it. But it's things to do with like the direction. Like, I prefer like the menacing look of the black and white version of it. I don't think the Daleks look particularly compelling. You also have the negative of the lack of Barbara and Jaclyn Hill in this film. And those kind of things are played to this film's detriment, in my opinion. And Doctor Who and the Daleks, in my opinion, is a better adaptation. And if they were to do a cut down version of Dalek Invasion of Earth, I don't know why you would. I don't think it really needs one. But I would welcome that as opposed to this film. And that might be a very controversial opinion, but...
No, not necessarily. I think the advantage that it has is that the Dalek Invasion of Earth is a much better story than the Daleks. So Doctor Who and the Daleks really couldn't fail to be better than that, because it's seven parts of pure boredom, to be perfectly honest, controversially. So I think, you're adapting Dalek Invasion of Earth, which is basically great as it is. As I said even in the review, like, I love a lot of it. I would maybe trim some bits, but I don't think you could change much. And it's still a really good story, whereas the Daleks is begging to be cut down from those seven parts, because it's way too... They still mucked it up when they did the in-color version by cutting too much and editing it poorly and adding bad music. But I think, there's only 90 minutes worth of plot in that seven-parter in the first place, whereas Dalek Invasion of Earth has more to do.
It's got like two good episodes and then four or however many else are like decent or poor. And there's one or two episodes that are just outright bad. I feel like there are only two worthwhile episodes in that seven-parter.
It's a slog. I mean, I know some people love it, and I love what it gave us in terms of introducing the Daleks and stuff, that seven-parter, but it's a slog. I mean, that's a review for a different time, but it's rough to get through all of those anyway. So, but whereas this, as you said, I don't think this is better than the TV serial, because the TV story, in its six parts, uses them better, and even the things that I would cut, they don't take up that much time, you know, the little subplots that they do cut in here, like the dude looking for his brother, or, like I said, getting rid of the Slither, thank God. I'll move us on then, because I don't want us to take too long. So the next thing I have is the acting, and I only have a couple of things on this. We've talked about a lot of that stuff anyway. We touched on sort of Bernard Cribbins, and like I said, Jill Curzon not doing much. I like Roberta Tovey getting a bit more to do, as we said. I do think Peter Cushing is... he's not very present in this movie. He gets a lot less to do, whether it's because he was unavailable due to injury or whatever. I think I read a review somewhere that was like, you can see why his name is removed from the title of this movie, because Doctor Who doesn't get a lot to do and seems quite ineffective for most of it. Although the only thing I can really remember him doing is giving the kind of command for the Robo-Men to destroy the Daleks, and even that doesn't work.
and he gets the three of them out of the prison cell like they do in the television.
But using the comb instead of, so
but
it's
like,
kind of quicker.
But like, even unlike you said you preferred this version. I prefer the TV version again.
I never said I preferred this version. Oh, when they escape. I prefer this version of the escape. I just don't like that scene.
I mean, I felt like it was too easy. Like with the other one, it seemed like padding again. It was about 10 minutes, like, and then it brought in logistical reasons, like, why was that machine there in the first place? Whereas this movie adaptation, it feels like it's way too quick. So it feels like they overcorrected and made it oversimplistic. And, you know, I definitely prefer that. Again, I will sit for an extra 15 minutes of whatever the TV show, you know, churns out than some of the things that this movie does, because it's way too easy. I can't disagree more, to be honest.
I get that it's easy, and I'm not saying it's better in terms of being a better written kind of logical thing. I just don't really care. I want to get out of that room, and if it does it quicker, I don't mind, you know, whatever. I just don't want us to be sat in a cell for so long. It's like, okay, whatever. I can buy it. They can use the comb to break the electromagnetism. Cool.
I suppose so. But then it kind of ties into like an acting thing. I way prefer William Hartnell to Peter Cushing.
And I obviously, yeah.
Whether in this film he has very little to do compared to Doctor and the Daleks and compared to William Hartnell in the actual TV serial of it. But that 15 minutes where he's in the prison cell, you actually get so many great one-liners from William Hartnell delivered so brilliantly and effortlessly that you kind of get a connection with his Doctor. And he's very witty as well, and very, you know, even him insulting the dude that was in the cell with him, that's funny, that's amazing. Whereas you get none of that in this film. So I feel performance-wise, that you need those kind of moments that the television show offers to kind of...
I will say, kind of say to counter that, because, and I don't know if it's because I saw this first, I like kind of the pacing. It doesn't waste any time getting you to the situation, and then once you're there, and it's something I like this better than the original. Not the original, sorry. I'm really talking at my ass there. The first film. I feel the first film treads water kind of a lot. It really lulls. It's got that Sunday afternoon feel, where to me this one, it speeds things along a bit more, and I kind of like that. I obviously prefer the TV serial. It expounds upon a lot of things, but I do think that it does it well with what it needs to do if you don't think too hard about it.
Yeah.
Will, your points are valid if that's your taste, but I'm kind of with DK that I prefer the pace of this because it makes it kind of a bit more exciting. But that was also my issue with the music, is that the pace is already fast enough. I don't therefore need the music going like, dun, 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 dun. Like, yeah, I get that it's tense and quick and whatever. We don't need it. Stop ramming it down my throat. You're not Murray Gold.
But that's the thing. These sound like the exact criticisms that people have, like the in color versions of like the Morgans and the Daleks. So, how would you compare this to like the Daleks in color, for example? Because I feel like the pace of the original serial was absolutely fine generally, and it went around breezily in the original. So why did we need?
Oh, this is way better than version? The Daleks in color.
In this film, you have the intelligence test. Be the Doctor literally puts something under a door, and it raises.
I mean,
that seems
it's
like
kind of logical. You know what I mean? Break the electromagnetism is something that you wouldn't necessarily think of, but it works.
Mean,
you know what I mean?
Something under the door and trying to lift it up kind of seems logical to me. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's not what was happening. It was more of like, you know, it's electromagnetic, and that's what they use. So breaking the seal would do it. And what do you have to do it? We've got a comb. That's fair enough. You know. Either way, like I said, it's all just pacing. It's not like it's ridiculous. It's not like it comes out of nowhere. And I don't think you necessarily need it. You know.
I do think it's funny that, you know, they pass the intelligence test, and it's only one person really that passes the intelligence test. You've got two dumb fucks in that cell with them.
That's what I mean. Well, and like,
I really looked out with that.
When you look at what happens to poor Rory Kinnear, I was like, that's harsh, because there's no guaranteeing he would have passed the intelligence test and been taken to be robotized. That's Doctor Who's fault. And the poor guy is like, he's the only one of the three of them that gets it done to him. And it's horrible when you see him later in the movie and they're like, oh, give us a hand here, Cranston or whatever he's called. And he's like, nope, sorry, I'm a robot man. Oh, damn. although it did beg a belief that they were trying desperately to undo his clearly not particularly strong restraints. You know, Doctor Who's and Tom's immediately came off, and they're like desperately trying to make his look like they're stuck, just we can't free him,
because I'm watching that.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy, just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And I'm just thinking, do you know what? With my luck, yeah, I'm like, get me out of here, dudes. Can't, it's stuck.
I will say, and I know this is a controversial opinion, and it kind of touches on more kind of direction, production, etc. But I much prefer the robot men in this movie than the ones in the TV show. I've already read people disagree with me, including like actual critics and stuff. I think the ones here just look... I know it's just a bike helmet with goggles and a radio stuck to the side, but compared to the really, you know, like basic said, helmet...
It's the black leather and whips in it, dude. That's what it is.
A whip? I wonder what that's for. No, it's not. It's more of an iconic-looking costume. I mean, Will, you've been there. You were at the convention where we bumped into the Dalek cosplayer and the guys that are dressed as the Robo-Men from this movie. Like, they look kind of... It just works better as a costume than, like, oh, it's a quick helmet that's going to immediately fall off that looks like a proto-Cyberman thing. So, anyway. Maybe that's just me. I don't know.
No, I agree. It's just a shame about that one scene with Bernard Cribbins with the Robo-Men and their food. That kind of lets
that's what I mean. It just completely detracts from the horror or the reality of it, and it makes it look stupid.
The lack of acting, like, needed from the Robo-Men so much is, like, a massive praise, considering that was negative of the actual TV show. Like, they're supposed to be intelligent, however, they act like they're dumb. So thank God that they don't have to, you know, actually portray anything. And they are seen as quite physical because they obviously get into the fight with the... with the prisoners, they do get overthrown, but naturally, because they're so overrun, there's only so many of them, way more humans. I do agree.
Cool. I mean, but I was going to say, like, with regards to the acting, first of all, like I said, I really felt Peter Cushing's absence, I think, in this movie, because it feels like, for the lead character, I just don't know if he's...
He does kind of feel like an afterthought, yeah.
Yeah.
And I know it's not, you know, it wasn't intentional, but... It is what it is, I guess. I didn't know this, but apparently Sheila Stafel was dubbed completely.
Oh, well, I know it happened a lot in those times, but I didn't realize it happened here. That's fair enough.
And then apparently all the uprising, all female extras were asked to vacate the area before the uprising section was filmed.
Huh, weird. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I know that there's... I didn't notice it this time myself, although I did look for it, but I'm told that there's a scene where one of the extras thinks they're out of shot, and then as they're running away from the kind of exploding mine and the big uprising, they just stop and start casually strolling because they think they're out of shot, and they're not.
I've noticed that, yeah.
I want to see that. That's got to be on the riff tracks, surely.
I looked for it, but I couldn't spot it this time around, and I wasn't about to go rewinding and looking back, and I was like, I'll find it later.
You mentioned that, didn't you say you'd watched the trailer for this?
Yeah. It's on the set.
Yeah, on the trailer with the Ray Brooks, he's described as the boy with the knack.
Boy with the knack, yes.
Yeah,
I had to look that up because it's all I can think about now.
Yeah, he's apparently the year before he starred in a film called The Knack and How to Get It. So I'm guessing they were cashing in on that. But he just comes across as really weird when you see that trailer.
That's why I looked it up, because it's the one line from the trailer that sticks in me, because it's like, that sticks in my head, sorry, because it's like him throwing a bomb at a Dalek, and then it's like, and Ray Brooks, the boy with the knack.
The boy with the knack. Every time he appears on screen now, and it's one of those things that I saw it years ago, but every time he comes on screen, I just think, oh, it's the boy with the knack.
That's true. But I kind of love that trailer, because it really makes this thing seem way more kind of over the top and melodramatic than it actually ever is. The way it's like, men made of metal, how can you defeat metal with flesh? These men have invaded Earth, how will we stop them? It's like Daleks invasion Earth flashing up. I love Philip Madoc as an actor. I think he's great, but whatever direction he was given here and whatever he's given to work with props wise and stuff, it is so arch. Like, you know from the start he's gonna betray them and be sinister. He's got like a cigarette and a Mac, and it's kind of like, you know, he is evil dude 101.
Yeah,
you know?
Kicking that can over. And there's like one lingering shot. There's a lingering shot when he's in the shed and he's smoking a cigar. And you can just imagine the director going, nice one, Philip. Moss man. And it's on him for about 20 seconds. And you think, is this the end of the film now? Are we going to get a solution to the Daleks that we're just focusing on Philip Madoc?
giving him his moody, like, I'm smoking a cigarette, so I am evil kind of thing. Yeah. But yeah, that scene, I completely forgot that. It's so freaking ridiculous the way he's like, oh, that smells good. Try some. And then just kicks it over.
Yeah.
What a dick. Why did you be such a jerk?
You know, Ray Brooks is just saying, you do that for your twat.
Yeah. I'm the boy with the knack.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's all I have to say on that. I much prefer Philip Maddock when he's playing, I can't remember the character's name, the dude from Brain of Morbius.
Is it Soren?
Solon, maybe? Yeah,
Solon.
Yeah, he's great in that. He's also good in the War Games. Any last thoughts on the acting quickly before I move us to direction and try to
let's move on. I will say, Roberta Tovey really holds her own in this. And
Definitely.
Earlier, and Andrew, it's not an easy thing when she's alongside, well, not really Peter Cushing, but Andrew Keir, who is a fantastic, you know, character actor. So the fact that she can hold her own against these kind of heavyweights, it's weird that we didn't see more of her career-wise as it went on.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, yeah. Well, she's all over the special features on the DVDs, Blu-rays, etc., though. So talking about the movie, doing commentary and stuff, Roberta Tovey, I mean. So she's not ashamed of it or anything.
Oh no! I just think it's a shame we didn't see more of her as an actor going off.
Yeah. Speaking of which, because that moves us on to the direction. This movie was again directed by Gordon Fleming. If you didn't know, Gordon Fleming is the father of the actor Jason Fleming, who you will have seen in Guy Ritchie movies and a bunch of other stuff. He's also
the Iron Mask and shit.
He's also all over the special features talking for his dad. Which I find is kind of nice. Like, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't disregard it or anything. It's like, yeah, no, it's my dad. He did it. I'm happy to talk about it. So, yeah, did you have any quick notes on the direction before I start going into my bits of pieces?
I've only got a couple. The 60th Street, where the opening robbery takes place, it's the same one in which Wyler and Susan encounter the Dalek Patrol over 180 years later.
Yeah, I haven't known that.
it was the unchanged Mitchell real estate premises and Harrison Sun Shop, that which are prominent in both sequences. Obviously, there was going to be a third one, but apparently it was never made due to the disappointing box office and the producers thinking that The Chase just wouldn't have made a really good movie.
Yeah, I should say it's been disputed now that they were ever going to make a third one. So some people claim that was never the case. It's just conjecture. So who knows? We might never know the truth.
I mean, The Chase would have made a great film, in my opinion. Again, similarly, there's so much to that. Imagine that.
You could make an epic trilogy out of the Daleks Master Plan, 12 episodes. No, more. In fact, I think.
That'd be like Avatar for the 60s. I will say, I know I'm the one that harps on about this, but they did continue the stories in print.
Did they?
Yeah. The first one was in BBC's collection, Short Trips and Sidesteps, The House on All Dark Moor, which is a follow-up to these movies.
I'd be interested to do that, because I wouldn't mind spending more time with this version of, you know, this non-canon or whatever version of Doctor Who and stuff. So, yeah, that could be cool. I'll look that up when we go. So, what was I going to say? Yeah, to your point, I find it just so jarring that there's almost no attempt to make 2150 look any different than the 1960s in this movie. It's completely unchanged. All the posters and shop windows and everything are the same. Like, the one thing Dalek Invasion of Earth gets right, even on a TV budget, is that 2150 looks like a wrecked far future. It doesn't just look like, you know, oh, it's 1960 still. Whereas this, I'm just kind of like, I never get the sense that they're in the future at all. And for a film with, you know, a good big budget and some production design stuff that's really good, you know, where it can do things that the TV, you know, budget can't when it comes to sets and scope and stuff, I just think it's kind of criminal they made no effort. And I'm not sure if it's just because they needed to have the contemporary Sugar Puffs adverts in there. Who knows? Maybe. But yeah, I just thought that was weird. I do love the action sequence of them escaping, attacking the Dalek ship. But I think the jaunty music is completely incongruous to that. Like you were saying, like, it stops being bombastic and turns into jazz club when they're doing a big action sequence. And I'm like, what are we doing here? I love the effective shots of, like, the bodies and the destruction after they've put down the rebellion. Like, again, that's quite dark for a movie like this. The scene of them blowing up the van is really cool. I actually like the Dalek ships in this, even though I know they're not the, you know, the iconic ones of the TV show. One of the Robo-Men, there's a scene, I can't remember exactly where it is, forgive me, but it's when the Robo-Men are being shot at and they're on the water. One of them falls into the river way before he gets shot, and it's so noticeable. That's got to come up on the riff tracks, because, yeah, there's like two or three of them on a log or something, and they get shot, and one of them, yep, way before they've even pulled the gun practically, this dude just face plants into the river. Like, oh, come on. And I've kind of mentioned the rest, yeah. So I've talked about, I love the memeability of the I Regret Nothing of the Crashing Daleks, and the, like I said, the James Bond type scenes at the end and the great motion with the Daleks. So, any thoughts on directing from Will? I'll come to you because you've been quiet for a while.
Yeah, no, I like the scene where, like, the prisoners overthrow the Rovermen and one of them chucks a knife and it goes into the Roverman's leg. I thought that was quite shocking. I had never obviously seen this movie before about a month ago, so I had seen the gif of Dolly retain into the hole and I thought, holy shit, this is where it comes from.
Yep.
Finally. And I thought, it didn't disappoint. I thought it lived up to the gif.
It's actually my profile picture, by the way. I found it.
Yeah, brilliant. I thought it did it justice at the start, because one of my favourite moments of, you know, the direction of the TV show was the scene where the bridge collapses and all that stuff at the start. I thought that was just as effective, in my opinion. I do think at the end it kind of loses its way with the, you know, the hammy joke at the end, as opposed to the heartfelt, bittersweet Susan departure. I feel like I do agree with a lot of people's criticism at the end, where it kind of just feels like it's rushing to the end and that it doesn't really have an ending tacked on. So the final 10 minutes do kind of, you know, speed run to the end and doesn't really have a resolution, which I do kind of see. And the lack of a third film does definitely, you know, emphasize that as well, because at least with, you know, how classic you ended with Survival, you have that retrospective, you know, monologue added in to kind of wrap up the story, whereas you don't really have that with this one. You have this scene that kind of breaks Doctor Who's rules, so it kind of leaves you on a really sour taste. However, yeah, besides the end and the final 10 minutes generally, I quite like the direction, and I think, you know, I can't remember who mentioned it earlier, but the set design was phenomenal as well. So the set, the people who did the set deserve a lot of praise, besides, of course, the exterior bits where it's a destroyed thing. But however, you do see an actual cutaway to Battersea Power Station in this one.
Yes.
That's kind of destroyed, and I feel like that was more effective because you didn't see it at all in the...
Well, you do if you watch the version with the updated effects, by the way.
Yeah. So yeah, it's very hit or miss, but I'd say generally the direction and the art design in general, it is very, very good. So, you know, I would see no reason why the son of the director would have any reason to shun or look down.
No, definitely not. No, but some people are like that when it comes to sort of sci-fi or 60s type, you know, low-budget British type stuff. Comparatively low-budget, I guess, but yeah. DK, any quick thoughts on direction or production design, etc.?
I just think I think it's quite well-directed. I mean, it's competent, but it's brisk, and it moves along quite quickly. It's just, it flies by for me, this one.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, same. I actually really like the pacing on this one, and I think it makes it a very entertaining watch, even with the flaws. You don't really notice till you're actually analysing it, for me. I have a couple of notes on the VFX production design, if you'll indulge me. First of all, this is just really geeky stuff, but the set designers often use everyday household items as Dalek technology. On multiple occasions, you can see lava lamps as exotic decorations. The devices used to convert and program the Rubbermen are, as I was taking the mic, simply salon hairdryers retrofitted with cables and futuristic elements to make them look more sci-fi. And as I said, the Rubbermen helmets are 1960s motorbike helmets combined with a portable radio that's just been glued onto the side. And finally, there are no Dalek lights on the Dalek that emerges from the river. In actual fact, you can see it wobble quite noticeably because it's just an empty shell. There's no operator or anything in it. Otherwise, you wouldn't get it into the water. So it kind of sticks out if you're paying attention to those things. But you kind of had to pay homage, I guess, to that iconic scene from the TV show. So we'll forgive it, I suppose. Cool. So yeah, that covers VFX. We've talked, as I said, we kind of talked about the music, so there's not really a lot to add there, I don't think, unless you guys wanted to jump in. No?
No.
No. The only thing I've got for that is music from both films. It was released by Silver Screen Records. If you want to listen to it at home, if you're a fan of jazz, I'm not sure. An unlimited edition double vinyl in 2016.
They stole our name. We should clarify Silver Screen Records is not connected to the Silver Screen.
Come on,
yeah. Fair enough. Cool. Well, as if you are a regular listener to Cinema Classics, you'll know that in lieu of asking the audience their thoughts, I tend to just, when it comes to these movies, look at the critical response to them. And there's not a lot for this movie because it's probably not particularly a regarded classic, but, you know, it's a classic to us in our hearts. And so, yeah, I do have some information about the way this film was viewed critically, which I'll jump into just now. And say that this film was given a negative review in the Times newspaper on 21st of July 1966. They said, "The second cinematic excursion of the Daleks shows little advance on the first. The filming of all this is technically elementary, and the cast, headed by the long-suffering, much ill-used Peter Cushing, seem able, unsurprisingly, to drum up no conviction whatever in anything they are called to do. Grown-ups may enjoy it, but most children have more sense." Ouch. Yeah. In their text, The Great Science Fiction Pictures, co-authors James Robert Parrish and Michael R. Pitts noted that the cinematic sequel was, quote, "not nearly as good as the first." Phil Hardy's The Film Encyclopedia Science Fiction claimed the film was directed carelessly. Completely disagree with that one, but okay. Alan Jones of the Radio Times gave the film 3 stars out of 5 in a retrospective review in 2015, stating, "Independence Day, it's not, but director Gordon Fleming keeps the colourful action moving swiftly along to cheap and cheerful effect. Youngsters will love it, while adults will want to exterminate Bernard Cribbins, who provides comic relief as the bumbling Bobby. Yet through all the mindless mayhem roll the ever-impressive Daleks, truly one of sci-fi's greatest alien creations." In a review of the 2013 Blu-ray release, Starburst reviewer Paul Mount said the feature was, quote, "a leaner, slicker film than its predecessor, its bigger scale and lavish location filming giving the story room to breathe and allowing for some effective action sequences, such as the rebel attack on the impressive Dalek flying saucer." A Blu-ray review from DVD Beaver, Behave, notes that the film's restoration offers superior image quality compared to the first film. The review emphasizes the film's improved visual presentation, making it a worthwhile upgrade for fans seeking a better viewing experience. And I'd echo that when it comes to the 4K, by the way, the colors and everything, just one of those films that you really want an upgrade for.
Restoration is a bang-up job.
Yeah, completely. And finally, on Rotten Tomatoes, the film holds a 69% rating, which I was surprised about, based on 13 critic reviews and a 54% audience score from over 1,000 ratings. This indicates a generally favorable reception from critics, while audience opinions are more mixed. And again, surprised. I thought this was going to potentially be more critically, you know, reviled than it actually is, it seems. So, yeah. So there you go, Will. It turns out critics actually did really like this film, surprisingly enough. But yeah, the next thing then, we've got a couple of things to do. First of all, we're going to do what I always do on my reviews, which is to go around and give our favourite character moment and line. And Will, would you like to go first as the guest for this?
Okay, so I would say probably my favourite character was Bernard Cribbins' character. Mm-hmm. Despite that god-awful scene with the Robo-Man, I loved him. I thought he was a good addition. Unlike you, I thought he was incorporated into the story quite well. Okay. Don't really have a favorite line. Doesn't really have many memorable quotes, this film, in my opinion. And what was the other question? It was the favorite line, but favorite
moment line. Or scene, anything like that that stands out?
Oh, favorite scene. It's probably, genuinely, even though I mentioned it earlier as like a negative in terms of the lack of Barbara, like going for the Daleks, I think they were able to like destroy more Dalek props in the film. So I would still say the Dalek's been destroyed with the car going through it, like the van, the truck.
Okay.
I thought that was a really good moment, how they could expand on that scene from the TV show. That was really good.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So, DK, you want to go next favorite character moment line?
Character, it's going to be another one for Bernard. I love Tom.
Not surprised.
He's a great character for the audience to identify with. So, line, it's not the line because it's just a throwaway one, but the way Cushing delivers it, where they do escape from the cell, they're caught, and he goes back in the cell. He just looks kind of resigned. It's just such a deadpan way that he delivers it, and I love it.
Yeah,
that's cool. A good one.
Did you give a moment or scene?
The scene, I'm gonna go for the kind of like the uprising where they free the Doctor and Tom from the ship. I like that whole, yeah, you know, throwing knife, boy with the knack, bombs going off. Yeah, I like that.
Awesome, cool. Yeah, no, that was close for me, but it wasn't what I picked. My favorite character, I actually went with Susan. I said, despite being younger, she gets to be more proactive. And I think Roberta Tovey is actually quite a good child actor, which you rarely get, especially in the 60s. You were usually quite obnoxious or, you know, just annoying. My favorite moment, I think it's got to be the ending, the first thing I saw. And, the scenes that launched 1,000 memes of Daleks regretting nothing as they fall to their death. I just love it. And my favorite line, which is purely, it's probably not something I would have picked were it not for the fact that the actual casing, the box and everything for the 4K set makes a point of it, and I find it really hilariously fitting. So my favourite line is, we'll have to bypass Watford, the place is full of Daleks. Because I think that sums up this film brilliantly, just so British, and yet, you know, full of Daleks.
You know something? I thought you were going to go for that that one at the end. You see, Susan, there's always a problem. There's always an answer if you only dig deep enough. I thought those puns would be right up your street.
No, I'm with Will. Not to end a film where it's been sort of, you know, fairly dramatic events have been happening. I think your ending on that is very, you know, no. Although the actual ending isn't much better, but I do think Cribben sells it the way he's like, whoa, cool, Tom Campbell, MBE, oh, yeah, no. You know, because he's caught the jewellery thief or whatever. But anyway, so yeah, all that remains for us to do then is to give our conclusion and our score out of 5 stars. Then we'll put it together and give a final score. So, Will, would you like to go first, or would you like to give a bit of time to gather your thoughts and us to go?
Nah, so I got my Letterboxd review. I simply said evidence that an extremely higher budget doesn't result in a product that's even as good as what a lower budget can do. Similarly to what I said earlier at the very start, what I will say it has going for it is the obviously superior production value and the extermination effect. Mm-hmm. Again, considering how the Daleks were based on, the Gaslight effect really, really works. And I'd give it a 2 out of 5. So
okay,
lesser in terms of size review, like inclusion than my other two reviews. So I apologize for that, but I still something.
That's your review, dude. You've got to be honest. So yeah, fair enough. DK, do you want to go next?
Yeah, mine's only a short one. I'm probably going to be the outlier here, but I enjoy this one tremendously. I think it's brisk, it's fun. You don't think too much about it. You don't have to. If you do, you end up, you know, having an aneurysm. But it's just kind of B-movie 50s sci-fi fluff, even though it's like 10 years too late. The performances are decent. The music's tolerable. It fits in some places. I know there's, you just think you've taken too many drugs, but I just think the thing looks good, and the restoration really does this a favour. And yeah, as I say, I prefer it to the first one, so I give this 3.5.
Wow. Okay. Mine is kind of short by my standards. I said it's definitely a film that improves with repeat viewings, especially if you can embrace its old-fashioned charm and camp. There's plenty to admire here, but also a few notable missteps. Unsurprisingly, it doesn't quite reach the heights of the TV serial it's based on, which is a comparison that's impossible to avoid. One clear benefit is the shorter runtime, which strips away, for me, much of the original's extraneous filler. Thankfully, no bloody slither this time. However, this streamlined pace comes at a cost. Several key moments and well-written ideas don't get the space they need to fully land. The bigger budget pays off visually, though. The film looks spectacular, as you said, especially in the newer versions, boasting a scope and scale the TV series couldn't have dreamed of at the time. There are definitely some memorable set pieces, but the trade-off is a hit to characterization. The 2150 natives fare okay, but the supposed leads often feel, ironically, a little two-dimensional. The omission of Susan's departure arc is a notable loss from the TV version, and Tom's comic relief antics veer into outright cringe, more fitting for pantomime than a film that otherwise leans surprisingly dark in tone. Flawed, but enjoyable. I found it a very watchable, distinctly British slice of sci-fi cinema. Worth a look, definitely. And like I said, I liked it a lot more on this watch, but don't skip the original TV story in its favour. And I also give it 3.5 out of 5. Weirdly enough, DK. Which, by adding those together and dividing by the three of us here, gives a final score for Daleks Invasion Earth of bang on 3 out of 5. That brings us to the end of our Technicolor Terror trip through Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD, where the explosions were plentiful, the Robomen were as confused as we often are, and London was pretty miraculously unchanged in 200 years. So huge thanks to our brilliant guest for joining in the battle against the campiest Daleks this side of Skaro. Will, it's been a blast, man. Where can folks find you online and what would you like to plug? I know you've got some upcoming cool stuff.
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram as ever, WillTemplar03. I'm on YouTube as just my name, Will Templar. I do more like just entertainment, general entertainment videos. But if you're a Doctor Who fan, which I would assume if you've listened to all of this, you can check out the game shows that I do, Doctor Who orientated game shows. The channel is literally called Who Game Shows, all one word. It'll be in the description if you want to do that instead. And, you know, I'm partnered about on this channel quite a lot recently, and the Hit or Miss Who Trek channel as well. So if you want to hear more from me, you can go over to some of those episodes and I'll be there as well.
And of course, thanks as always to my co-host, time traveling titan of all things camp and cult, the one and only DK.
Oh, been a pleasure, mate.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, I always like talking about films with you, especially when it's, you know, things that we are, our particular Venn diagrams combined with these cheesy things.
Yeah. So, yeah. It happens more often than you'd think.
It kind of does, yeah. And yeah, if you've enjoyed this episode, and let's be honest, how could you not after that much retro chaos? You can find all our links, socials, and bonus content via our link tree in the episode description, or if you're watching on YouTube, just follow that handy on-screen graphic. And if you want more of this glorious nonsense, whether it's space adventures, cinematic deep dives, or philosophical arguments about whether a Dalek could defeat a Tribble in single combat, make sure to subscribe to the Hit or Miss Who Trek channel. We've got fresh reviews of Star Trek and Doctor Who coming out pretty regularly and a hefty back catalogue to enjoy. In fact, next Sunday on that very channel, we wrap up our current run of Dalek dissections with a review of the big one, Genesis of the Daleks. Time travel, moral dilemmas, and Davros at his shoutiest. Do not miss it. Meanwhile, right here on the Silver Screen channel, we've got a smorgasbord of cult flicks, stone cold classics, and a few mainstream bangers coming your way in the weeks and months ahead. So keep your eyes peeled and your snacks close. Yeah, until next time, watch something old, love something strange, and share the joy with friends. That's cinema.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Cinema Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Cinema Classics is hosted, produced, researched, scripted, and edited by Michael Wilson. Additional material by DK. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Links to all of these places can be found via the link tree in each episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production created by Mike Wilson. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Join us again next time, and hopefully this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Here's looking at you, kid. Cut!
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.